Okay, who did their homework? 3, 4, 5 people? Raise your hands up high. Sweet. Okay, and I know Travis did. Travis today gets an assist on this message because we message back and forth and wrestled with this all week long. So if you don't like it, you can blame him. If you do, then I was, you know, I'm just kidding about that. All right. Okay. Like I said last week, it's important, especially for this remainder of this book of Revelation, to at least begin by looking at the whole thing at once, getting the whole sweep of this narrative. Okay, you can just castrate it by looking at it in little bits without having the overall sense of what is going on. We read this part last week, and this is when John goes into this vision, has this vision of this throne room, for lack of a better term. It says, "Then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?' And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it." This scroll contained something that to be unable to read it, for it to not to come to fulfillment, was just this cause of sorrow, deep, incredible shock and sorrow to John. This, I think, with this scroll represents God's story, God's grand story of the reclamation of all things, of God's story of summing up all things under Christ. It's this cause, if it could not be read, it's this cause of deep sorrow. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its 7 seals." Okay, so now is when it's going to start to get interesting, right? Those of you know who read this past week. I want to start by, before we get into the show, I want to talk about the structure of the rest of this vision. I want to think about how we experience and how we think about and how we talk about significant events in reality, okay? What is this a picture of? The Twin Towers. On what date? September 11th, what? 2001. Who remembers where they were and what they were doing that day? Who wasn't alive? Okay, it's fewer than I thought. It's one person volunteered. Okay, I remember I was in college at the time, and had a late class that day, so I was still in bed. And Shelly called me. You know, it was very unusual for her to call in the morning. She called and said, "You need to turn on the TV." She said, a plane has crashed into one of the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center. Like, wow, okay. So I got up, turned on the TV, and there was this. Everybody remembers this, right? And they were saying, somebody said it was a Cessna had crashed into it. And I think, you know, it makes sense if you think about buildings that we're normally associated with. Because you look, you know, the wingspan of this plane that accidentally crashed into the building doesn't even go across the whole thing, right? I mean, you think about it in terms of scale of buildings. Yeah, a small plane crashed into that's a terrible thing happening. And then at what, 9 o'clock, what happened next? Bang. Who was watching when that plane flew in? Yeah, I was. And you're like, oh, that was no accident, right? I think for a lot of us, for anybody much younger than me, I think it's going to be really hard to grasp how different the world is on September 12th than it was on September 10th. I think it's just really hard. And I think I was just at the right age where I could actually know. I could remember the 90s? Yeah. And the biggest thing going was whether our president was, you know, having fun with the interns. What a big deal that was. The economy was just roaring. You know, because of the Cold War was... Because I'm old enough to remember the end of the Cold War, right? There's another hugely significant event. What is the image, the scene of the end of the Cold War? Yeah, I should have put a picture of that. The kids with, you know, tearing down big sections of the Berlin Wall. Who remembers that on TV? Yeah. Because what was the world like before then? You know, it varied a lot, but I mean, bomb shelters and air raids and the radioactive symbol was part of our lives then, right? You didn't know, you know, there were times throughout that period from the 1950s all the way up to the 1980s where you didn't know if there were going to be a nuclear war or not. But now in the 90s, that's gone, that's done, everything's great. You have this little war, kind of like watching a video game on TV in the Middle East, you know, in Iraq, where you just have these video game images of stuff blowing up and it's all cool, you know, wave your flag. That's great war, it's this great fun thing. That was way back at the beginning of the 90s. By this time, thing was great, and then this, it just, it's a different world. It's a different world now. In so many ways. 2,997 is the official count. That includes the hijackers died in the attacks, not only on the Twin Towers, but the Pentagon, and also the attack that was foiled, and that plane crashed in Pennsylvania. That one was headed to Washington, D.C., they think, to the Capitol building or to the White House. Think about what would happen if that had succeeded. Anyway, 3,000 people. President Bush, he remembers this speech on the 20th, when he stood up this joint session of Congress, right? This was televised. George Bush began this, and Mr. Speaker, Mr. President pro tempore, members of Congress, and fellow Americans, in the normal course of events, presidents come to this chamber to report on the State of the Union. Tonight, no such report is needed. It has already been delivered by the American people. We have seen the state of our union and the endurance of rescue workers working past exhaustion. We have seen the unfurling of flags, the lighting of candles, the giving of blood, the saying of prayers in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. We've seen the decency of a loving and giving people who have made the grief of strangers their own. My fellow citizens, for the last 9 days, the entire world has seen for itself the state of the unions, and it is strong. Tonight we are a country awakened to danger and called to defend freedom. Our grief has turned to anger and anger to resolution. Whether we bring enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done. Now whatever you think about or what he said in this speech, this was a good speech. Okay? Whether we bring our enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done. So what happened after that? Buildings blew up. No more in New York, right? You know, we attacked and invaded Afghanistan to take down Al Qaeda, which was this loosely, affiliated, or maybe not so loosely, but an affiliated group of terrorist cells, you know, globally, who've been active for a long time, you know, headed by Osama bin Laden. And because by connection or as a corollary to taking out Al Qaeda, we also had to take down the Taliban, which is the ruling regime, is very, insidious, Islamist, fundamentalist regime that had taken over the nation of Afghanistan, fall in the unrest following the Afghanistan-Russian war. So we didn't just take out Al-Qaeda, we had to take over the whole country. What about lives that were changed by this? Okay, here's the thing. Here's one of the biggest differences in the world now versus the world in the 90s up through 2000. Okay? We have been at war. Our nation has been at war 17 years. Okay? In one conflict. Think about that. It doesn't really touch us. We don't never really think about it. It doesn't touch most of our lives. But what about our veterans and the people who have served in this 17-year-long war? That boggles your mind. If you had gone back to 1998 when I graduated high school, says, hey, you know, by the time you're at your 20th year reunion, our country will have been in a 17-year war. Like, you are insane. Did you see what we did to Saddam? Right? Of course, as you know, we didn't. A couple years later, in 2003, we went to war with Iraq. You know, directly related. I think it had to, you know, in most people's eyes, it was related to 9/11. One way or the other. Afghanistan war to date, 50,000 combatants on the, I don't want to say good guys, but on the Allies side. You know, most of course, the bulk of that would be the Afghanistan National Army. They're 50,000 deaths. Okay, I don't want to get into casualties, injuries, just deaths. 70,000 on the side of the Al-Qaeda, you know, Northern Alliance, those folks. 70,000 bad guys died, 35,000 civilians, okay, in Afghanistan. In Iraq, 25,000 combatants on the Allies side, 35,000 on the Iraqi side dead, over 100,000 civilians. That's just in the official Iraq war, okay, from 2003 to 2007 or 11. 2003-2011. After that, victory, we won, we leave, and then there's this civil war, of course, like there is. 2011-2017, another 35,000 combatants on the Allies side, good guys side, 55,000 combatants dead. These are numbers of dead on the bad guy side. Another 30,000 civilians. Okay? I didn't even add all those numbers up. Thank you. Okay. So our world's different. My world's different from pre-2011 because our economy has suffered. You know, we spent trillions of dollars in these battles. You know, things are a little bit. We have homeland security now, all the wonderful stuff that goes along with that. So my world's different because of that. But what if you're the dad, that kid right there? Not that kid. We can't imagine it. What if you're the dad? What if that's your son? Is your world different now than it was? You know, I don't even want to think about it. That's just not a discussion whatsoever of whether this war was necessary or whether it was even a good thing, you know, in some respects. I don't care about the politics. I will think about the people's stories. Think about just lives that were changed, all back related to this event. Now think about the life of the dad of that kid. What was it? How would you feel if you knew your, what, 9-year-old son was standing looking at a soldier who was shooting at somebody over here? Because what's happening? What's going to happen to whoever this guy's shooting at? Yeah, he's going to shoot back. Does politics matter? That guy's dad? No. The upheaval and the turmoil in this world, you know, that relates back to that event is just, I don't know. I don't think it's hard to overstate it. On the anniversary 9/11 this year, here you see people, all these people fleeing from the buildings as they collapse. And like 18,000 people in New York have been sick in the years since 2011 related to this dust. There's so much toxic stuff, including carcinogens, and people have, you know, gotten cancer because they breathe this stuff in. But anyway, there's a story, and a guy had this interview, and it was really, really heart-wrenching interview. This guy was running late for work on that day, and he was in the tower, like one of the towers. I remember it was the first or second tower, but he was like 10 or 12 floors up, you know, going to work when the plane hit. So he turned around and was headed back down. You know, he talked about all the chaos, just the unbelievable fear. You know, he had called his wife and, you know, just one of those things. You know, I may not make it back home. You know, I love you. Can you imagine making that call? But he made it out. Eventually, he ran. He got out safely, and he what stuck with me, he talked a couple things. He talked about getting on the train back to the suburb. I think he lived in New Jersey. He said, and it was just, the train was just packed. absolute stand, people standing in the aisles, you know, seats were packed. Not another soul could get on this train, people leaving the city. He said it was just deathly, absolutely quiet, and nobody said a word. As you would, you know, this unbelievable shock. You know, his world had been turned upside down. And he says, and he goes, and he finds out his wife is not at home. She's at this church service that had been called, you know, this extemporaneous church service for people to come gather. So he goes, and the church is packed, just packed out. And he walks in the door, and everybody turns around to look, and his wife sees him. And he says, and I knew then that this was a big deal and the world was different because my wife is never one to show emotion, you know, especially publicly. You know, she's a very reserved person. She got up and jumped over, you know, the backs of the pews, you know, jumping between people to get to him, and ran up and hugged him and kissed him. He said, and then at that moment I said, I knew I was home. I knew I was home. Okay. Now, why do we do all of that? Okay. I want you to think about like this is 9/11 and its effects on the world. Okay? What is this? Manual? Fossils. Yes, it is a rock. It is full of fossils. Okay? There are many different species, different types of shellfish. There's coral. There's little bitty bits that are unidentifiable. This is a piece of, you know, fossil-laden limestone from Kentucky. Okay, so yes, this is a rock. This rock represents, this may not work, okay, if it falls flat or whatever. this rock represents 9/11 and its effects on the world, okay? Are you with me that far? We're thinking way, way outside the box. This is how my mind works, okay? Warning. This rock represents 9/11 and its effects on the world. Are you with me? This is the reality. This rock is the reality of 9/11 and its effects on the world, okay? Are you with me? Okay, what's it composed of?
Limestone.
It's composed of limestone. It's composed of fossils. It's composed of, what else is it composed of? Go to the next layer deeper.
History,
yeah. Let's go to the next layer deeper in physics. Thank you. Atoms. What else?
Quarks.
Quarks. Yeah, atoms, electrons, protons, quarks, whatever, okay. Okay, the world, the reality of 9/11 and its effects on the world, what's it composed of? It's composed of events and statistics and numbers. It's composed of a timeline, right? What else is it composed of? People and their experiences, emotions, stories, you know, memories, right? That's real. That's reality, right? Okay, now. Whoa, didn't expect that to happen. Now this, okay, is what I just told you about 9/11. Okay? What did I start with? Started with a picture and my story of where I was on that morning, right over here. Then what I talk about next? Statistics, and then war, and George Bush's speech, and all this stuff. And then over here was, you know, going back in time, this dude escaping the flames and getting home to his wife, right? And we, you know, this, you read from, actually, left to right. That's my story, right? How is it related to this? Is it this? No, not at all. But is it just this? No, this is so multidimensional and so layered and so deep. There's so many things to it. We can't possibly ever just encompass it with one or two words. So what I do, I went around. It looks different from this side than it does from here, There's different shells here than there is here. It's all different. No matter how you turn it and look at it, there's so many different angles and perspectives and points of view, and that's just on the surface. To really dissect it, you would bust it up and break it down and put it under an electron microscope, right? But all I did, in this very disjointed way, I'm not a real good storyteller, my story just kind of wrapped around and around and around, right? And then when I went back and forth in time, and I should have prepared a better way of doing it. I just put all that together this morning, okay? So went around and around and around and around, trying to look at it from different points of view. You got me? From different angles. You got me? To try to have this bare sketch that within you could, that I could take out and read and tell you in a linear fashion, right? You with me? I can't believe you're nodding your heads. Okay, now, this is not 9/11 and its effects on the world anymore. This is the story of existence itself. This is creation. This is the big story. This is a story of God summing up all things in Christ. Okay? This is God fixing the world. Okay, you're with me? Okay? That's this. Okay? And it's got different angles and different sides. There's different texture to it. All right? Now think about all of the humans. If you could, okay, the story of God's reclamation of all things. Who could tell a story related to that?
God.
Yeah, God. Yeah, the God could tell. Who else could tell a personal? Yeah, very good point. God could tell a story of that, right? Yeah. Karis, could you? Yeah. Like what?
Like Kaya being born.
Yes, like Kaya being born, right? And being born, you know, with health problems, right? Did you feel God working and moving in that moment? Yeah, absolutely. What else? God's reclamation of all things. Who could tell a story about that? Huh? Yeah, thank you, Lisa. Lisa said, you know, Lisa said salvation. Here's a story that when you met Christ and you formed this, when God saved you. Right? And now, stretch that back and forth in time to encompass all of God's story of reclamation of all things. How many stories would there be? How many layers? How many atoms? How many electrons? Right? Are you with me? This is a big rock. Right? Okay? But at the end of the Bible, located at the end of the Bible, we have John with this revelation. Okay? And I take the book of Revelation literally. Okay, and it's in the only way, meaningful way of using that term. I believe John had a vision. Okay? A lot of people don't. But I think John actually had a vision that saw these things. Okay? And this is it. We can read it from here to here, right? That's the only way we can read or experience anything is along a timeline and in succession, in a succession of moments or in a succession of words in this case, right? Okay? But how is John's vision related to this? Is this? Come on, somebody just say, is this this?
That's part of that.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's part of it. Kind of like this, if you ask me. All right? Kind of like this. Okay, it's wrapped around it. This vision wraps around the outside of it, and you see certain things from certain angles, and then you go to another angle, and you see it again, right? And still, all we're doing is like this. You know, John starts at the beginning of his vision. What happens at the beginning of his vision? Come on, you guys read this all week, right? Yes. Yes. Very good point. Yeah. He starts with Jesus appearing to him, giving him these letters to the churches. Then what next? Huh? The churches, we said that. What happens after the churches? What happens? What do we read next? After the churches? The Lamb, the throne, the scroll, and he cries and line the tribe and all that. Then what happens next? Seven seals. Right, what happens next? Trumpets, which are part of the seven seals, but I'll give it to you. Trumpets, and then what's next? Huh? Okay, whatever. Go on to the end. Then what happens? Huh? What happens at the end? Alright, so if I'd taken my time and actually did like a rubbing, right? What we have here is kind of like this. Oh my gosh, what is this? This is crazy. This is like an acid trip. It's like a vision. It's a vision of the surface of this, but it's wrapped around it. and it's just imprints. It's just, it's we can see patterns, and we can see suggestions, and we can see symbols, and yes, there's code in there too. But it's the imprint of this. So what's the important thing to keep in mind here? Is it this? Is this important? Heck yeah, I'm glad we got it now. I used to know, you know, whatever. Which is the important thing? Yeah. So this is important in what it can teach us about this. You right? And what it shows us about this. Okay, did that work? That was probably way too much time involved in that. Okay. Whatever. So, let's talk about the wrapping around and the structure of this vision. It starts with, like you said, the seven seals that are sealed up this scroll that this thing is holding. Okay, this scroll that's full of words written front and back. Okay, this is just this huge story, just dense and packed and extensive. It says, I watched as the Lamb opened the first of these seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come or go. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make people kill each other. To him was given a large sword. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come. And I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in its hand. And I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages and 6 pounds of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and wine. When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come. I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death. And Hades was following close behind him. They were given the power of a fourth beast of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. These seals are open. And with these first ones, anyway, this rider on a horse comes out. Now, some people read Revelation as history written in advance, right? As if John was seeing these things, and these things are actual historical events. What he sees is an actual historical event, literally, and he just can't understand what's happening, so he describes it with the terms he best has. Like I remember when I was a kid, I had been like 9 or 10 years old, and this guy said, in this Sunday school type class, this guy said, the locust. Anybody read about the locust last week during your homework? He said those are actually attack helicopters that this guy, that John saw, and because he was this first century peasant, he didn't know what was going on, so he tried to describe this attack helicopter best he could, okay? That's reading Revelation as history in advance. I don't think that is the best way to do this. I don't think you're taking it very seriously if you do that. And maybe there's some of that here, I don't want to remember that phrase, I don't know. Okay, but what I'm going to talk about today is not that, I'll put it that way. Before we go on, so I'm talking about, let's just think about these horses. Fiery red horse, its rider is given power to take peace from this one. The white horse, and its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown. He rode as a conqueror bent on conquest. So we're thinking about how John's vision relates to this. What in this seems like that? Huh? Lots of stuff. Thank you, Chad. How many conquerors has there been in the history of humanity? Lots. Bent on conquest. This, in this way of reading, this way of thinking, this represents some future conqueror, though it might include that. It is not limited to that by any stretch of the imagination. This is not a conqueror. This is conquest itself. And the horrible effects it has had on humanity. This is one of the effects of sin as it comes to its full strength, as it comes to its full expression in people, in society. One of the expressions of sin and evil is conquest. And period. Second living creature, a fiery red horse. This rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make people kill each other. How much violence and unrest has there been in the world? A little bit. A lot. This again, how the effect of sin runs its full course. One thing that happens, this is not just some future unrest or some future violence, though it may include that. This also represents violence itself. The Lamb opened the third seal. I heard the third living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in its hand. And I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages, and 6 pounds of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and wine." Now, for us who grew up in the States, this sounds like the good guy. Yeah? That sounds like Wall Street, right? Oppressive economic structures and economic conditions. We get the benefit of that, guys. In a lot of ways. But for a lot of people in the world, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages and 6 pounds of barley for a day's wages, that's a horseman of the apocalypse. Right? Think about how we read this, and we think, oh, sometime in the future, things will get real bad. And this may include some time of economic hardship in the future, but it is not limited to that. When we read that, that's all we can think of because we haven't experienced that, most of us. But how does Jasper hear this? Or Roberto in Guatemala? 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages. Yeah, that's right. That's how it is. Oppressive economic practices and structures and famine and insufficiency of resources are a part of what happens when sin runs its full course. When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse, its rider's name Death. And Hades was following close behind him. What's Hades? You know, some of the translations will say hell here, right? What's Hades? Huh? Huh? Somebody said underworld, right? That's a trick question. Here's a better question. Because is that true in Greek mythology? Huh? What did you just say? Say it out loud. Yes. Hades is the god of the underworld. Now, we use it by extension to mean the place of the dead. But what's it called? I forget. I really hope you know. Huh? No, Sheol is a Hebrew word for the place of the dead. Talk about Hades. You got a cross river stick. Whatever it is. Okay, somebody can tell me later. Tartarus. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Is it Tartarus? I don't think. Is that what he's god of? Anyway. Hades, by extension, is often referred to, is used to refer to the place of the dead, but in Greek mythology, this is a dude. This is a god, right? That's what makes sense for Hades to be following along with this guy on the horse, right? So you have Death, and the god of death, or the place of the dead, following along, if you want to imagine that somehow. But you have these characters coming, and they're given power of a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, by the wild beasts of the earth. Again, death is the ultimate expression of what happens when sin is allowed to run its full course. So are these things a judgment of God, or are they what happens when sin runs its full course? Yeah, Travis and I don't, you know, we're still wrestling with this. So is this what happens when sin runs its course, or is it B, a judgment from God? Thank you, both, yeah. Both. In some cases, what's the difference? I'll say, in some cases, what's the difference? God says, okay. So what he, basically what he told Adam and Eve, you guys ate that tree, it's fine. That was a mistake. You're creatures with agency, and now you'll get to see what happens. What happens is death. Sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. How does Jasper read this one? I mean, that sounds like what you hear about Africa on the news, doesn't it? Yeah. So, does this thing mean it's not referring to something in the future? No, it doesn't mean that. Does it mean it's exclusively referring to something in the future? I think absolutely not. Okay, remember, we're talking about this. A reality that can't be encompassed by these few words. These are just a sketch, just an image. It's a sketch of an image, okay? An impression. So, that's the first section with these seals. Okay, and related to the seals are the seven trumpets. That's part of the last part of the seal, these seven sevens. You know, the completion of completions, when these two numbers are added together. At the end of Revelation 11, it says, then the seventh angel sounded his seventh trumpet. There are loud voices in heaven which said, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and his Messiah, and he will reign forever and ever. The 24 elders who received on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, we give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was, because you have taken your great power and begun to reign. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead, for rewarding your servants and the prophets and your people who reveal your name, both great and small, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. Yes! You get to the end of Revelation 11, like, yes! It's done. And God wins. God triumphs through this. And his people are vindicated through this, through these seals and through these trumpets, right? Okay? And then what happens? Okay? Then either, depending on how, me and Travis just disagree a little bit. Depending on how you read this, it either continues, or I like to think there's a scene change. Think about it like a movie. You have this vision, there's this movie just. Then it forever and ever, and it fades to black. And then, pow, then I witness an event of great significance. You know, that Travis laughed at this one. I have to say, Travis has got a weird sense of humor. Because after all this stuff, you have these seals and these trumpets, and you have the angels proclaiming victory for God. Well, then I saw something that was really significant. Right? I think it's like this scene change. Okay? And there's another very, very, very different. Okay, we started out here. You looked at this facet, this side of this reality of God's reclamation of all things. And then you go over here and look at it from this angle. And this angle is not this recitation of events that symbolize certain things. This is a story, the narrative. Okay, instead of this CNN hour-long special reporting on, you know, the future history of the world, now we have a play. A stage play. Okay? So then I witnessed in heaven an event of great significance. I saw a woman clothed with the sun, the moon beneath her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant, and she cried out because of her labor pains and the agony of giving birth. Then I witnessed in heaven another significant event. I saw a large red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, with 7 crowns on his head. He swept away 1/3 of the stars in the sky and threw them to the earth. He stood in front of the woman as she was about to give birth, ready to devour her baby as soon as it was born. It's drama. You see the drama? It introduces these characters and builds up this drama, and then we see how they act through this. It's like a play. Like, I can imagine people, you know, dressed up with these wild costumes, you know, to barter theater, you know, with minimal props and lighting and you're doing this play, right? And it tells the story of this conflict that is sometimes taking place on earth, and sometimes it's taking place in heaven, and sometimes in between. People go back and forth, and it's wild, and then there's the earth, and then there's the ocean, and then there's just kind of this corollary. Part of this play is this beast rising up out of the sea. Had 7 heads and 10 horns with 10 crowns on its horns. Written on each head were names that blasphemed God. And then, the last part of this play, though, you have code. Lots of code in here. Not just symbol, but code that if you pick through this and you figure things out, like to the end. Wisdom is needed here. Let the one with understanding solve the meaning of the number of the beast. What is the number of a man? His number is 666. Okay, now this... Now, this is breaking out of the narrative tale. When he says, wisdom is needed here. You guys pay attention, like wink, wink. Or like literally. Like John is winking at his audience. Who was? The Christians in these 7 churches in Asia Minor under the control of the Roman Empire, right? Okay? You with me so far? You're like, wink, wink, think about this. And there's crowns and horns and all this stuff and lots of code for Rome here. Solve. Let the one with understanding just figure this out, guys. Wink, wink. Pay attention. Let the one with understanding solve the meaning of the number of the beast. This is the number of a man. His number is 666. What does the number of the beast mean? At least one. Okay, you. At least one meaning of it. Absolutely, in my mind is settled. What is it? Huh? Nero Caesar. Numerology, his name adds up to 666, period. Okay, and there's a discrepancy between some of the texts, a few of the texts of the New Testament have 666, and a few of them have 616. Okay? The language that 616 was originally written in that manuscript, guess what it adds up to in that inflection of the language? Nero Caesar, okay? That's what John was talking about here. At least one meaning of this. Okay? So, at least one meaning of that. So you have this stage play, the woman and the dragon and his beast and then the sub-beast of the beast. And it's all kind of this stage play. And at the end of it, you get this code if you were in the original audience. And you're seeing what Rome is actually like and what's actually happening behind, with Rome behind the scenes in terms of God. But you can see it without being killed. Or John can write it without being killed because he's talking about Caesar, right? It's kind of this, it's just code. But then, 15, I saw another marvelous event of great significance. Okay? So, we talked about this, what did we talk about? How long have I been going on here? I'll shut up a minute. The seals and the trumpets and the fact that then you had this play with the conflict between the woman and the dragon, right? And now we got another one. Marvelous event of great significance. 7 angels are holding the 7 last plagues which bring God's wrath to completion. Okay, this is a facet of this reality which makes it look like and brings out the aspects of this reality that are shaped like the Exodus. Okay? Over and over again, for out of nowhere, he talks about Moses. Moses has the people of God singing a song which sounds exactly like Moses' song after he crossed the Red Sea. It mentions the tabernacle. And it mentions plagues, of which there were plagues in the Egyptian Exodus, right? Plagues which aren't exactly the same as this, don't get me wrong, but have echoes of these same plagues. This is reframing how this reality is kind of like a stage play and this conflict story, and it's kind of like these series of events, this news documentary, but it's also kind of like the Exodus, right? Okay, are you with me? Some of you maybe, perhaps. Then one of the angels, into this, one of the 7 angels who had poured out the 7 bowls came over and spoke to me. Come with me, he said, and I will show you the judgment that is going to come on the great prostitute who rules over many waters. The kings of the world have committed adultery with her, and the people who belong to this world have been made drunk by the wine of her immorality. Then we focus in a little bit on one of the narrower facets of the reality of God's reclamation of all things, and we think about empire itself. Okay, leaving all, you know, all of the evil stuff about God, all the stuff that's wrong with the world, we focus on empire. We focus on Rome, Babylon. We think about oppressive, corrupt power regimes. Oppressive and corrupt power structures in the world, okay? Has that ever been a problem? Yeah. Is it still a problem? Yeah. Right. We think ours is bad. We think our politicians are blooming morons. Go to Guatemala, right? and then have a volcanic eruption, then have your government lie about how many people were killed and refuse money to help their own people, rather have their own people suffer and die than to be seen in the international world as looking like they need help. Okay? That's just the bare, that's not even that bad. We're talking about empire, talking about corrupt power structures and another kind of a drama type setting, another scene, another very stylized, symbolic scene here. But then, finally, after all this, and there's more, you could break these down into yet different scene changes, you know, fade to black, new scene, how I think of scene. I think you could go even more, even deeper, or maybe some of them should be combined, I don't know. But then finally, you get to the end, and it says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven and the old earth had disappeared, and the sea was also gone. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven like a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. You know, the sense of just finally relief. This washes over. You come through all of this conflict and all this pain and this suffering and this uncertainty and this fear. And then in contrast to the great whore of Babylon, okay, you have this great prostitute, this great whore sits among many waters, and the kings of earth have committed fornication with her, right? At the end of that tale, you have the marriage supper of the Lamb. Take all of the corruption and the sin that you're committing with this prostitute, and now you have what? In stark contrast to that, what do you have? You have a marriage. You have a wedding. And it's white. And it is pure. And it is good. It is good. It's a holy city. A new Jerusalem coming down from God out of heaven like a bride. Beautifully dressed for her husband. And you see, it's fixed. And you see, the overall reality of this, no matter where, how you trace the story around, it always ends up here that God wins. And it's fixed. It's done. And it's good. Now, why in the world would God go to the trouble of this, of describing this to his people? Why in the world would you have all these, would you have this wild psychedelic acid trip of a movie? Why would he talk about it? Why would he just say, I win. Love wins. I'm going to fix it. Why? There are many, many reasons, but here's one. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this message for the... This calls for patience. This is a kind of a clue within some of these parts in Revelation. I think this is a clue, a kind of a place marker that says, hey guys, this is where you're at in this story right now, okay? Well, if that's the case, I don't know. That's just kind of how I thought as I read it. But this is why. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people. Why would God go to all this trouble of telling us all this bad stuff going to happen? Because otherwise, you might run the risk of having this superficial, shallow faith that every time something bad happens in this world, comes down the pike and touches your life in a negative way, you think, this stuff about God, that's BS. Anybody know anyone that's ever been there? Yeah. Right? I thought God loved me. I thought God was good. You know? What about this? I can't believe in this. This is baloney. This is ridiculous. God doesn't work that way. He says, look, things are going to be bad. They have been bad at times. They are going to be bad at times. They are bad at times, but I win. And I win this in spite of the fact that things are going to be bad. I win through those things in so many times. He's telling these people in first century Turkey, he says, look, you are under the thumb of the Roman Empire, and they are going to crush a lot of you. Don't let that make you think that they are winning, because they are not. In the end, the whore dies, and you marry me. So I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this message for the churches. I'm both the source of David. I'm the beginning of this whole faith of yours, and I am the, and also the heir to his throne. I'm the bright morning star. I win. I shed light into this darkness. So the Spirit and the bride say, come. Let anyone who hears this say, come. Let anyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who desires drink freely from the water of life.